Verestanize as self-advocacy. Thank you for listening, and I hope you join us for the next episode.
Today's episode was made possible thanks to the hard work of Eugene Holden, our webmaster, Carrie Cantrell, our showrunner and lead producer, Amanda Antel, host and producer of Let's Talk Autism, and Mary Newman, our production assistant. This episode featured audio and transcription editing by Carrie Cantrell and music by Mary Newman.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture. Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resource Department, and the PCC Multimedia Department. We air new episodes on our home website, our Spotify channel, and Cable Radio 90.7 FM.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kbu.fm.
You're listening to KBOO, independent radio since 1968. Support our station and fight the status quo by donating to our spring membership drive, now through May 25th. During our last week, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, up to $20,000, thanks to a group of anonymous donors. Click on the red button on the top corner of the app to donate. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa Lesniak, the creator and host of That Vegan Show. Tune in this Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland to hear my interview with Katie Bester and Eric Sugarman, recent graduates of the Lewis and Clark Law School. We'll be discussing animal law and the functions of the Animal Legal Defense Fund chapter at Lewis and Clark. Hope you can tune in to That Vegan Show this Friday at 11 a.m. right here on KBOO FM.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm. and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Hi, I'm Jill Fritz with the Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Hi there, and welcome to this month's edition of Voices for the Animals. I'm Michelle Coppola, and I am so glad you're here. So today, I am going to revisit some urgent animal welfare stories from the past few months and give you some updates. Many of the stories and issues involving animals that we've covered here have had developments, and I wanted to share them with you. But before we do that, first up, there is no way that a show like this can ignore the story about Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota and her unashamed revelation in her book that 20 years ago, she shot a 14-month-old hunting dog for misbehaving. Now, she's made a lot of excuses for her actions, refusing to show any remorse. She's also claimed that the story has been widely known in South Dakota for years, and because her opponents have used it against her in the past, she, quote, wanted to set the record straight. However, according to reports in the South Dakota Searchlight, those claims are apparently untrue. When asked, none of her past political opponents were aware of that story until she told it in her book. News station KELO in South Dakota spoke with a couple of hunting dog breeders, by the way, that are in the area, and say that Noem had better options than shooting her dog in a gravel pit.
I think any dog isn't really a good hunter or a great dog until they're like 3 and 4 years old, because then they've started to settle down a little bit. And by 5, you've got the perfect dog. You can rehome dogs, and I've helped other people do that. You can go to a dog behavioralist and find out if there's an underlying issue with a dog that needs to be corrected, and usually they can.
You know, I just think a lot of really great things are happening in South Dakota, and this really broke my heart.
That was Dan Griffin, a hunting dog trainer, and Bob Eucher, a hunting dog breeder, both from South Dakota, speaking with KELO. Now, not surprisingly, even some Republican leaders are coming out against Noem about these actions, and political experts are saying that partly because of the negative reaction to this story among dog-loving Trump supporters, she is now not likely to become his running mate, which was what she was, if you'll pardon the pun, shooting for. It's also worth noting that while representing South Dakota in Congress back in 2018, Noem was one of only 50 federal lawmakers to oppose a law that made dogfighting and cockfighting illegal in the United States. All right, our first story update is following the status of the EATS Act, which when we talked about it here on Voices for the Animals back in January with the president of Animal Wellness Action, Wayne Pacelli, was still in the House Agriculture Committee. Here's Wayne explaining exactly what the EATS Act is and what it does.
The EATS Act stands for Exposing Agricultural Trade Suppression Act. It's a real mouthful. And really, it's just the latest effort by the factory farming industry, in particular the industrial pork industry, to unwind very modest state rules to give animals more space and to also restrict the sale of pork from operations that severely confine the breeding sows. The breeding sows, you know, for the last 40 or 50 years, most of them have been confined. Of the 6 million sows who are in the U.S. Pig breeding population, most of them have been confined in 2-foot by 7-foot cages called gestation crates. So these are basically the pre-birthing crates. So the sows are pregnant, and these are animals who can weigh 300, 400, 500, 550 pounds. And they are essentially immobilized in these crates for 4-month stretches, which is the period of their gestation. So they cannot turn around. They can barely take a quarter step forward. And these are intelligent animals. You know, they have the emotional intelligence and the general smarts of a dog. So if we did this to a dog and we put them in a crate barely larger than their body for 4 months at a stretch, that would qualify as cruelty under many state anti-cruelty statutes. And the pork industry didn't like the reform efforts in Oregon, California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Michigan, Ohio, other states that have banned these crates. And they were particularly agitated about California's Prop 12, which was passed overwhelmingly by voters in November 2018. It had a phase-in, and as of January 1, 2022, that measure was supposed to take full effect, and it would not only have expanded the space allotments for breeding sows in production facilities, but it would have stopped the sale of any pork that came from those factory farms that confined the sows. They challenged it, they being the pork industry, and they challenged it in the courts. They lost in the district courts. They lost in the appeals courts. They got this in front of the U.S. Supreme Court, much to the surprise of a lot of observers. And then this conservative U.S. Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that California exercised its proper authority in passing the statute. It did not invalidate Prop 12 like the National Pork Producers Council and the American Farm Bureau Federation wanted. That was a huge loss for them. We celebrated, as did many others who care about animals. And then immediately after that, the allies of the National Pork Producers Council and the Farm Bureau got legislation introduced in Congress called the EATS Act, and we've been battling away in the Congress since that introduction to thwart its advance.
You know, you touched on this when you were answering that question, but I do want to make the point that it's estimated that 1 in 4 pigs being raised for meat in the U.S. actually belong to Chinese-owned companies, and a lot of people may not realize that. In your opinion, how invested and powerful are these foreign interests in seeing the EATS Act get passed?
The pork industry or the pig industry is the biggest example of foreign-owned agriculture in the United States. Two foreign-owned companies control 40% of the U.S. Pig population. And the biggest one, or the bigger of the two, is Smithfield Foods, which was acquired by the Communist Party of China in 2013. It was enabled by a $5 billion loan from the Bank of China, which is a state institution. And now it is wholly controlled by the Chinese government. The second big actor is JBS, which is a Brazil-based company. We don't have precisely the same acute concerns about JBS as we do about the government of China. In China, what we're seeing are high-rise factory farms, as many as 29 stories high, with these, basically it looks like a giant condominium complex in New York City. And it's filled with pigs who never get out of these rooms. It's a farrow to finish operation. That is the kind of Brave New World image, very dystopian vision of agriculture. If Smithfield Foods, which is the biggest member of the National Pork Producers Council, achieves its goal of passing the EATS Act, we will wipe out state rules, and we will then enable the Chinese to build these giant industrial-style high-rise factory farms in the United States. Some people may say, oh, that's far-fetched, that couldn't occur. Who would have thought factory farming would have started, where you have thousands and thousands of animals standing shoulder to shoulder? This is just the souped-up model of the same enterprise. And no, I'm deeply concerned about Smithfield Foods. When you think about food security being national security, why would we ever cede control of an enormous sector of American agriculture to a global adversary like China? And of course, China loves it because they can outsource the waste that comes from these factory farms to the United States. We can outsource zoonotic disease threats, a pig and avian flu virus, which in 2009 was a major threat in the United States. There are so many elements of this that are extremely dangerous. And frankly, I'm shocked that many Republican lawmakers who talk about being tough on China are just genuflecting to China by supporting the EATS Act.
That's Wayne Pacelli, president of Animal Wellness Action. So what is the status of the EATS Act now? Well, on May 17th, Congress released a draft of the new farm bill. And despite widespread opposition from both Republicans and Democrats, Republicans on the Agriculture Committee included the EATS Act in it. Food and Water Watch also reports that included in this draft of the farm bill was a proposal that would remove climate-friendly requirements and climate-smart funding and instead give that money to the USDA for programs that are helping Big Ag and Big Oil, who have joined forces to rake in more profits by developing biofuel from manure, which, by the way, has very serious environmental issues. Now, what all this means is that because Congress moves at such a glacial pace these days, it is not too late to stop the EATS Act. So what I'd like to encourage you to do, if you haven't done so already, is to reach out to your federal representatives and senators lawmakers and ask them to continue to vote against the EATS Act and the Farm Bill in its current form. You'll find a link with the contact information for your congressional representatives on the Voices for the Animals page at KBOO.FM. You're listening to Voices for the Animals on 90.7 KBOO FM, your volunteer-powered and listener-supported community radio station. Today on the show, we are updating some of the animal welfare issues we've covered in the last few months. In April, we focused on the continuing war on wolves in our western states. Since Europeans settled America, humans have been systematically eradicating whole populations of wolves in this nation out of unwarranted fear and primarily for the benefit of raising livestock. While in more recent history, wolves have had federal protections off and on, most of their management has been left to the states where the wolves reside, which is really bad news for these essential predators. Amarok Weiss, Senior Wolf Specialist for the Center for Biological Diversity, was our guest on the show last month and explained the tumultuous history of wolf protection in our country.
So the policy wrangling and listing and delisting of wolves really has a complicated past. And so just kind of try to explain, we lost wolves in this country not because they lost habitat. That's what usually happens. That's what usually makes the species in peril. But we lost wolves in this country because we killed them. And we killed them because European settlers who came here had a very different view on wolves than many of the Native American peoples who've been living here for thousands of years with wolves had. And so we wiped out wolves almost throughout the entire lower 48 at the behest of the livestock industry. And it wasn't until 1973 that by that time we had had like this social conscious change where we realized that we were destroying the planet. We were destroying our water, our air, habitat for other species and the species themselves. And so in this period of time, under a Republican administration, under Richard Nixon, near unanimous vote in the House and a unanimous vote in the Senate to pass the Federal Endangered Species Act, along with other important environmental protection acts. And so in 1974, a year later, the gray wolf was listed for protection under the Endangered Species Act, and they were listed nationally. That is, they needed to be protected under the Endangered Species Act throughout the lower 48. They were listed as threatened in Minnesota and endangered everywhere else. And the only reason they had that lesser protection in Minnesota was because by that time, we had wiped out wolves everywhere except for far northeastern Minnesota. There was still a population of maybe 600 to 1,000 wolves there. And I'm from the Midwest. I know what those winters are like. My theory is the only reason that we didn't kill off those last wolves is because it was just too frickin' cold.
Right. I was about to say it's because there's no people up there.
It's very cold. So because of those protections, though, that meant that it was no longer legal to kill wolves. That allowed that Minnesota population to grow in size and expand into neighboring Michigan and Wisconsin. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also developed a recovery plan for the Northern Rockies. And the way they had to do that is that they captured wolves in Canada, brought them down and reintroduced them to Yellowstone National Park and into central Idaho. And that three-state region now, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, has a wolf population. And then they developed a recovery plan in the Southwest for the most highly endangered subspecies of gray wolf, the Mexican gray wolf, which also had been driven to extinction in the U.S. They captured the last few down in Mexico, started a captive breeding program, started releasing those in 1998. So now think about this. We had wolves throughout the lower 48, but the recovery plans were only for those three postage stamp size portions of the country, Western Great Lakes, the Northern Rockies, and the Southwest. And over the years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has repeatedly tried to strip federal protections from wolves, nearly a dozen times over the last 20 years. And whenever they have stripped them of protections, before a lawsuit could be filed and gotten those protections restored, once wolves have lost those federal protections, most of the states that have had wolves have instituted very aggressive hunting and trapping seasons that are designed to bring their wolf numbers down to bare bones. And then in 2011, Congress stepped in and forced U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to permanently delist wolves in the Northern Rocky states. It's the first time Congress has done that, and didn't allow for that to be appealed in court. And so that's the instance you're talking about, where we've seen such aggressive hunting and trapping,
right,
regulations and laws passed, and particularly the last few years, even more aggressive, even more barbaric as to where, how, and when wolves could be killed. There was a brief time in 2021 when wolves again lost protection throughout most of the lower 48. And in Wisconsin, within just a few weeks, they opened a wolf hunting season and in 2.5 days' time killed 20 to 30% of their wolf population.
Oh, my God.
Yes. So fortunately, we and other groups filed a lawsuit. We did get protections restored because it was very clear to the courts that wolves are not yet recovered and that the states don't provide appropriate safeguards once they lose federal protections. So wolves are still federally listed throughout most of the lower 48, but they are not listed in the Northern Rockies. And that's because, as I said before, when Congress forced U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to delist them, Congress put it into a rider on an appropriations bill, and it had language in it that said this could not be appealed in court. Now, that was 2011. So we move forward like more than 10 years, 10 to 12 years. We see Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming going crazy with all of these really anti-wolf hunting and trapping laws. We file another lawsuit, and so does another group, indicating that the service really has to relist them. We actually file what's called an administrative petition. It's not quite a lawsuit. Noting that the states are not managing wolves the way they said they would when they were delisted, and they're in danger of dropping down below limits that could really imperil the species again. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service denied that petition. We filed just about a month ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, our notice of intent to sue over that. The laws and regulations that have been passed in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming have no basis in science. They're designed to bring their wolf numbers down to just skeletal numbers. That does not allow wolves to fulfill their role in the ecosystem, which is something we talked about at the beginning of this interview. It's so important to have them back because of the role they play in keeping everything else healthy.
That was Amarok Weiss, Senior Wolf Specialist at the Center for Biological Diversity. Sadly, the news is still not good for wolves, as a few weeks ago, the U.S. House narrowly passed H.R. 764. Now, H.R. 764 is a bill that eliminates federal protection for wolves under the Endangered Species Act. Should this bill pass in the Senate and become law, you can likely expect to see wolves hunted to near extinction again in many western states, as well as acts of cruelty like the one committed by Cody Roberts in Wyoming that made so many headlines. You may have heard about it. Roberts is the Wyoming hunter who deliberately ran down a young wolf in his snowmobile, then taped her snout shut and showed her off at a local bar while she suffered from terrible internal injuries in the corner. He was given a $250 fine, but animal rights groups and concerned citizens are now petitioning local authorities to bring further animal cruelty charges against him. In the meantime, you can help see that the delisting of wolves does not happen by contacting your federal senators as soon as possible and asking them to kill this legislation in the Senate. Again, you'll find a link and phone numbers and addresses to your senators on the Voices for the Animals page at KBOO.FM. Next up, I wanted to update you on the continuing animal shelter crisis in this country, which we covered in late 2023. If you're not aware, U.S. animal shelters and rescues are facing a virtual tsunami of homeless dogs and cats and other small pets since the pandemic. Prior to 2020, as a nation, we had actually been making really great strides towards reducing euthanasia of homeless dogs and cats. Once the pandemic hit, we saw great numbers of pets being adopted and shelters were thrilled. However, that had changed drastically just a couple of years later. Now, like me, you might have thought this was the result of people going back to work and abandoning their pandemic animal companions. But actually, that's not the case. I spoke with Stephanie Feiler, Executive Director of Shelter Animals Count, about the real causes of the current animal shelter crisis.
That's like my favorite topic because it's ironically what led me to this organization. I was in an animal shelter for 12 years and during the pandemic, and I joined Shelter Animals Count in 2020. 2021, because I was hearing these headlines about pandemic pets being surrendered in record numbers. And when I was looking at the data at our shelter, I'm like, we're just not seeing that. And I thought, you know, maybe we're the anomaly. And so as I started to look at shelter animal count data, I'm like, nobody's seeing that. How is this? How are we convinced ourselves that this is the problem? So it is true that you know, those things did happen. There were animals that were surrendered because their people returned to normal and different routine, but it wasn't nearly, I mean, it was minimal. It was, you know, it's one of those like one story, and so we think it's a trend. And what we saw was happening in 2021 and persists today is housing and other economic-based reasons continue to be the predominant reason why animals are entering shelters through owner surrender. But the interesting thing is we actually have seen a decrease over the past 3 years, year over year, of animals being surrendered by their owners. And so the number of animals being surrendered has gone down, but the reasons in which they're being surrendered, being housing and economy, have gone up within that category. However, that's not necessarily, it seems like it could be good news on face value about owner surrenders going down, but we're seeing, especially for dogs, the rate of stray dogs entering shelters has significantly gone up.
Yeah. So what I think you're leading to here is something that I've been reading about, especially in places like Texas, where people cannot get their dog into a shelter because there's a wait list or the shelters are full, you know, that sort of thing. And so they're just dumping their pets, or they're calling them a stray when they're really not, so they can get them in.
Yes. That's what we're hearing anecdotally. We can't prove it yet. We will be able to look at it. We can't necessarily prove people's intentions and without knowing. However, the data would indicate that that's likely happening because the rate of animals being reclaimed has gone down significantly. And generally, regardless of how many animals are coming in astray, your rate of return would maintain. But because they're going down, it does indicate that animals are either being abandoned, they're being turned in falsely as strays because they are not able to surrender them, or a lot of cases when animals are truly lost, their owner may either think they can't afford the fees or truly can't afford the fees to reclaim and then just don't. So we're hearing from our shelter partners a lot about animals being microchipped and it going to the right phone number and right address and those owners not reclaiming, which is back to a lot of cases, the economy. So that's happening. And at the same time, the past several years, we've had a national veterinary shortage, which has reduced some of these community services that helped us keep animals out of shelters prior to 2020. It's also made it cost prohibitive in a lot of cases for pet owners to get veterinary services that they need, which ultimately result in surrenders. And then within the shelters themselves, there are constant veterinary job postings within animal shelters and even just within private practice clinics that rescues and shelters partner with. They're full with their for-profit clients and aren't able to dedicate their time and resources to shelter animals too. And so you have animals that would otherwise be very adaptable that are awaiting sometimes minor, sometimes major medical procedures, spay, neuter, dental cleanings, et cetera.
Right. Well, for people who may not realize, I do want to interject here. This is something I'm really familiar with. We are in this country in a real veterinary shortage. We are facing a time when there is going to be 15,000 fewer veterinarians than we actually need to service the pets in this country.
Yes, the veterinary shortage is a real concern. And at the same time, we still have staffing shortages and volunteer programs have not return to their pre-pandemic rates. And so you really just have not enough people. And what the challenge with that is, even when there are enough kennels, sometimes there's not enough people and those kennels have to be empty because there's still not a capacity to care for those animals. And so it's not always space. Sometimes it is just that full, complete resource package. And it's really where we're at right now is really the perfect storm of everything going wrong at once.
That's Stephanie Filer, Executive Director of Shelter Animals Count. Since I spoke with Stephanie, Shelter Animals Count has released the statistics for 2023, and I'm sorry to say that not much has improved. Here in the U.S., we are currently on track to euthanize more healthy, homeless pets than we have in years, and the situation is especially bad for large dogs. In 2023, an estimated 6.5 million animals were surrendered to shelters and rescues in the U.S. or taken into shelters by animal control officers. An estimated 690,000 of them were euthanized. That's up 15% since 2022. Right now, there are over 177,000 more animals in shelters than there were in the previous year. So, what can you do? First, we have all got to realize that somebody else isn't coming to save these animals. It has to be us. If you can, please adopt and don't support breeding by buying a pet. Also, consider fostering if you can, volunteering and donating to your local shelter or favorite rescue. And as the man said,
Bob Barker reminding you, help control the pet population. Have your pets spayed or neutered. Goodbye, everybody.
And that's going to do it for this month's edition of Voices for the Animals. Remember, we cannot bring you this show, which gives a voice to the non-human animals on our planet, without your support. If you're not a KBOO supporter, but you enjoy this show and other alternative programming that we bring you, please consider becoming a member or making a donation, okay? You can do that by going to KBOO.fm and clicking on the donate button, or by texting KBOO to 44321. You've been listening to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Michelle Coppola. And until next time, be kind to animals, to others, and most of all, to yourself.
Hey, everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7 Portland.